So in a few days' time is the Vaisak for one more year. And in the Buddhist world, all around the globe, there's ceremonies and festivities and so on prepared. In countries like Sri Lanka, they'll be doing parades in the street and so on. The UN has a big Vaisak thingy this year in Bangkok. So for us here in the forest monastery, Vaisak is usually a quiet affair. We're not necessarily going to organize any big events. Maybe we can talk in the next few days if we want to organize perhaps a thinking perhaps like a sit until midnight or something on the Saturday night, perhaps. But I'm not sure if I'm going to be here on Saturday, so. But as you all know, Vaisak, the occasion of Vaisak is the birth, Parinibbana and enlightenment of the Buddha. And that's according to the tradition of the southern schools, the Theravadan schools. In the Tibetan and Chinese traditions, I think today, certainly in the Chinese tradition, it's Vaisak is the celebrated as the birth of the Buddha, but other days for the enlightenment and Parinibbana, not exactly sure how they do it, but in any case, Vaisak is recognized as a pan-Buddhist celebration for the birth, enlightenment and death of the Buddha. So I think it's just worth offering a few reflections for this evening on what Vaisak is all about, or what the life of the Buddha means or can mean for us. Of course, one of the problems that we have is that when we come to the life of the Buddha, we receive a story of a man's life which has been filtered down through the imaginations and perceptions of countless minds through the millennia. And each generation reimagines the Buddha for their own purposes. And we can see this very obviously in the traditional Buddhist cultures, where if you look at the pictures of the Buddha and so on, that the Buddha always, of course, has the features of the local people. He looks in Thai paintings, he looks like a Thai, and the Chinese ones, he looks like Chinese, and so on. That's very natural and necessary part of human the human mind. And by doing that, there's not doing anything wrong. Of course, the Buddha didn't look Chinese, he wasn't Chinese, but by drawing him with Chinese features, then that's a way that the Chinese people can come to a more close identification with the Buddha. And so for us, as we develop, no doubt we'll start having more Buddhas perhaps with more Western style features, and perhaps drawn in ways or created in ways that's more suitable for us in our culture, our time. And so we always have to remember that in the relationship with a tradition or a culture, that by reinventing it is not doing anything different than what all of those cultures and traditions have done already. And they've reinvented the Dhamma and the Buddha and so on for their own minds, their own times, their own place, their own purposes. And we must do the same thing. We can't help it. Even if you try not to, it still will happen anyway. So if we leave aside the mythic elaborations of the Buddha's life, I don't want to suggest that these things are unimportant. On the contrary, they are very important. But they're very important because they tell you what the Buddha's life meant to to past generations of Buddhists. That's essentially what we get from reading the myths and the stories about the Buddha. What did the Buddha mean to those people? Why did they depict him in that way? Why did they tell the story in that way? And so we can learn a lot about how the meaning of this spiritual inspiration, the Buddha, changed and was recognized and was treated through different generations of people who were devoted to following his path. So as I'm sure you're all aware, my own tendency is, I think that there's value in looking at trying to catch a glimpse of the historical Buddha. And elusive as he may be, I think we can certainly at least come a few steps closer to him than I think it's not an entirely hopeless enterprise to try to do that. I don't think it's a waste of time. I think it has some very important consequences if we do that. So if we look at the life of the Buddha, the things that we actually know, then if we want to be rigorous about it, then of course we know very little. It seems very likely that he was born in Lumbini, and as attested by the Ashokan pillar at Lumbini, although I mean this is one of the few hard facts that we have about the Buddha's life, there is an Ashokan pillar erected a couple of hundred years after the Buddha's Parinibbana, and on that Ashokan pillar it carries the words Iha Buddha Jate in the Magadhan dialect. Pali would be Idha Buddhe Jate, and that's almost a direct quote from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Here the Buddha was born, and so it seems certain that those two passages are related. Either the Mahaparinibbana, the pillar is quoting from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, or the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is quoting from the pillar, possibly. But either way, there it is, carved in stone. Here the Buddha was born. So that's like a fairly solid fact. The Buddha was born in Lumbini. Or at least so we think. Actually, in recent weeks I read an article saying that the person who discovered the Lumbini Ashokan pillar was actually a charlatan and a fake, and was known for making fake inscriptions. So there's actually some question about whether whether that's actually even that little detail, whether that's actually true or not, which is quite interesting, isn't it? That's kind of one of the bedrock facts of the life of the Buddha, that we know he was born in Lumbini, and now we're not even quite sure about that. So let's assume he was probably born in Lumbini and grew up in Kapalavattu, just down the road, not too far away from Lumbini. It's northern India, right near or just around the Nepalese border. So it's a nice climate in those regions. It's not as hot as it is further south in the Ganges Valley area. The Sakyan Republic that the Buddha was brought up in was run according to it's like a descendant from the old tribal system, where there would be like a grouping of aristocratic clans who would sort of share the leadership among themselves, kind of semi-republican aristocracy. And so the Buddha was born named Siddhartha Gautama, and in one of the leading families in Gautama clan. brought up, by all accounts, in a life of luxury. And the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta that we just recited talks about the two extremes, the extreme of self-indulgence in sensuality and the extreme of self-mortification. And these two extremes are presumably talking about the Buddha's own life before his awakening, that when he was brought up in the life of indulgence, sensual indulgence, and then after going forth and doing all the ascetic practices and so on, doing the self-mortification. So it seems likely that that's what the Dhammacakka Sutta is referring to. And in the suttas, the Buddha talks about how he was very delicately brought up and ate only fine rice and foods, and all of his cloth and so on was made in Benares, which is renowned for its good quality goods and especially its cloth. So, brought up in family, try to imagine what that's like. And for those of you who've been lucky enough to visit India and have a look at some of the holy sites, even though things must be very, very different now, all the trees are gone and must be very different. The cities where the Buddha was brought up in and lived in are all mostly desolate areas now. But still, we can try to imagine what that was like in a kind of extended family environment and so on. And the day of the Buddha's birth seems to have been while his mother was taking a journey back from Kapilavastu back to the her maternal home of Devadaha. And that's quite a realistic detail. It's quite a common custom that the pregnant women, when it came close to the time of their birth, would return to their family home to actually give birth in their family home, even though it seems like a very difficult custom, pregnant women travelling across miles of countryside. But it seems that that's what they did, and there's quite a number of stories of women who ended up in the same predicament as Maya and giving birth while halfway along the journey. The baby was born, and leaving aside the question of all the miracles and so on which is are attendant on the birth, then perhaps the most important detail, and I think quite significant detail, is that the Buddha's mother passed away 7 days after he was born. And it's of course a very plausible detail. In ancient times there was a very high number of women who died from complications from giving birth, and so it was very common for women to give birth and then pass away. It seems likely to me that Maya was quite a young mother, although really there's not much we can say about her. We don't really even know her name. Maya is just a Maya itself means illusion, and it's only a name found just as the legend develops. It may well have been her personal name, but we don't really know that for sure. The Buddha himself just refers to her as the Bodhisattva's mother. My mother. So he was born, his mother passed away after 7 days. I think that's, personally, I think that's very significant. And I think that's giving us a very strong clue to a very formative influence in the Bodhisattva's development. And as a newborn baby develops its perception, the most powerful influence on that is the mother. And modern psychological studies have been reinforcing again and again how important that is to be held in the arms of the mother, and to be the gazing of the baby into the eyes of the mother is while that's happening, all of these kinds of connections are forming themselves in the baby's mind. It's actually all of those qualities of nurturing and love and all of those things are being taught and being formed. Acceptance and supporting. And all of those things are being formed in the baby as he's being held. And that happens primarily through the contact of the mother. And one of the first experiences of loss and trauma that an infant has is the absence of the mother. And of course that happens all the time. You know, the mother leaves the room. And the very young infant doesn't have what they call a perception of object permanence. So that they, when someone's either present in consciousness, in awareness, or they're not. And only later as time goes on do they realize that even though they may be gone, they still exist. Even though they're not actually, you know, I can't actually see them, that doesn't mean that they've vanished or anything like that, they've just gone into another room. So for all babies, all infants, the mother leaves and they have to experience a separation from the mother, you know, at one time or another. And then the mother comes back. But for the Buddha, of course, the mother disappeared and didn't come back. And, you know, when we look at the Buddha's teachings, you know, what does he say is suffering? And birth is, birth is suffering. What is suffering? Separation from the beloved is suffering. Yeah. And these are right there in the Dhammacakka Sutta, his first teaching. These are things which... Death is suffering. These are the things which the earliest known actual experience that Siddhartha Gautama as an infant that we can say with some degree of probability that he actually had is that loss and that separation from the beloved. And then that became the centerpiece of his teaching when he experienced his awakening. So in this sense, I think that it's not not implausible or not unreasonable to say that that the Maya or the Buddha's mother was his first teacher, and that the experience of loss and separation was like the first seed in his mind that led to his awakening. He planted that seed. Now, as the Bodhisattva grew up, we know little about his life, except the only event we know, again with some probability, is that is the experience of sitting in first jhana when he was a child. And this is a very widespread tradition. Again, it's something which seems to me to be quite plausible. And somebody who in his adult life obviously had a great bent for contemplation and a great profundity of wisdom and clarity of mind and sensitivity. So it's not at all surprising to me that as a child that he should have shown such tendencies and at a peaceful time just sort of sitting and going into jhanas. And the interesting thing about that is that he said it's when his father was absent. His father was away working. So again, that's a sign, somewhat interesting, isn't it? Like his first two experiences that's recorded that we actually know. The first one is when his mother's away. The second experience is when his father's away. And his father goes and he's left and he just sits. And in that solitude, he found peace. But he wasn't going to meditation courses and learning methods and techniques. He was just sitting peacefully. And I'm sure many of you have noticed this or experienced this, that sometimes we want to sit meditation and we can sit and do a formal meditation technique and we feel like we're really bashing away at it. We feel like we can't get anywhere, but then maybe we just go and sit in the forest somewhere, or sit by a creek or by the ocean, and that experience itself will bring more peace of mind without even trying to meditate. So it seems to me that it's something like this is what happened to the young Siddhartha, except of course on a very profound level. And like the first experience with the absence of the mother, that left a very powerful imprint and influence on his later teaching, in the same way that that experience as a child also entering samadhi also made a profound impact on his later practice and his later teaching. And as we all know, that the decisive moment in the Buddha's awakening was when he recollected that time of sitting in jhana as a child, and that was the turning point. That's the decisive, that's the critical moment. And so Amaggo Buddhaya, this indeed is the path to awakening. So the Bodhisattva grew up in his family, presumably, according to the stories, was married, and presumably had maybe several wives or concubines or something like that. That was quite normal for someone of his status in that society. But we have to be honest and say we don't really know. And the Buddha's wife is really a cipher, just like Maya means illusion. The Buddha's wife, we don't really know what to call her, Yashodhara or Yashovati or Bhadakachana or Bimba Devi or Bimba Megajata, or so many names. Almost every text and every tradition has different names for this woman. And in the earliest texts, she's Rahula Mata, Rahula's mother. Again, that's not an uncommon thing, that a son or daughter might be named after the mother or the mother or father might be known after their son or daughter's name. So that's not unusual, but we don't really know her. And we don't know anything about her, except there are some verses in the Tarikatha that are attributed to her. And somehow that life was not satisfying. Somehow something happened to Siddhartha to make him leave all of that. And again, leaving aside the mythic elaborations of that event that we find in the later stories, probably the earliest mention of this, and the earliest very specific mention, is in a sutta called the Atadanda Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. And that particular text, which is almost entirely neglected by the whole Buddhist tradition, says that when he was living in the home life, he said, I'll teach you the account of my going forth and why it is that I decided to go forth. He said, when I was living in the home life, I could see people living opposed to each other. Animanyehi vyarudhe. Just living in this conflictive relationship with each other, floundering around like fish in too little water. Acho apodakeyata. Floundering around like fish in too little water. And to me, that image, this very vivid, very simple image, a very vivid one, it captures that essence of the nature of the suffering of life. And to me, that's much more powerful than all of the kind of the stories of the divine messengers and all of these kinds of things that we find in the mythologized version. Just that saying, oh, people floundering around, they don't know what to do, just like fish in a dried up stream. Kinasote. Isn't that what life is like? Aren't we just like that? Don't we just flounder around? We don't know where do we go? Where can we go? All we've got is this little bit of water, and it's not enough. The stream's dried up, we've got nowhere to go. He said he looked all around, couldn't find a place of safety. Every direction that he looked in was full of fear. It was full of conflict. He couldn't find a safe place anywhere. So where can we go to find safety? Where can we go to find a refuge? There's always a feeling of vulnerability, exposure. Disvamang bhayamavisi. When I saw that, fear came upon me. Disvamang bhayamavisi. And so the Atthagamda tells us that looking at how humans and people all around had taken up violence. That's what Atthagamda means. It means taking up weapons. So seeing that the world around them had taken up weapons. And isn't that something that we can see? It's these days taken to a completely surreal extreme. You know, we've grown up in the post-nuclear generation. It's quite extraordinary. You know, ever since we were born, most of us here, when we were born, the world, for the first time, humanity had the capability to not only defeat the enemy, but to wipe out all life on the planet. In a policy known as mutually assured destruction, MAD. It's one of the best acronyms ever. And that's where we were born. I was born in 1966. It's at the height of the Cold War. And now we've kind of got used to this idea. You've just grown up with it. Since the fall of the Soviet Empire, we don't kind of think about it too much. It's still there. The nukes are still there. We can still blow each other up how many times. You know, what can you say? Mad. In the Buddha's day, he thought that the world was full of conflict. Yeah, what was the conflict he was talking about? He doesn't say it. Maybe there was tribal conflict. You know, maybe there was, you know, warfare on the borders of his country. He was in the Katiya clan, the warrior clan. So it's not at all implausible that he would have been involved in the training and perhaps in fighting himself. Who knows? The texts don't really say. Perhaps he was talking about violence within the city, place he was living, or conflict within the family, and so on. Possibly all of those things. But whatever the specific things that set that off, there's no doubt that the scale of it was minuscule compared to the violence and the potential for destruction that we can see around us today. And that is truly mad. So, isn't that just as valid and just as powerful a reflection for us as it was for the young Siddhartha? Where do we go to find a place of safety? Where is it in this world? with so many billions and trillions of dollars spent on weaponry, where is it that we can find safety? And so the Buddha, or Siddhartha at that time, looked, say, well, where is that? Why do people run around all the time? What is it that keeps us agitated, restless, always wanting to go here and there, do this and that? What is it? Why are we like this? And so this is that direction of inquiry which led Siddhartha on. Not be satisfied with shallow answers. Not be satisfied just to accept the sort of received tradition, the platitudes, the easy answers. Why is it? Why is it that we cannot be at peace? And so he said that he looked, investigated, and saw there's something inside the heart, like an arrow inside the heart, nestling in there. It's the arrow of craving. It's the arrow of desire, wanting, of attachment. When we're struck by that arrow, we can't control ourselves anymore. We will always be seeking, always thirsting, never satisfied, never still. So once we've seen that, once you've seen that arrow, once you've recognized it, then we can pluck it out. Once we understand what the cause of the problem is, we can pluck it out. And it's from there that we can find peace, we can find a place of safety, and we won't be forever running around like mad things at the whim of our defilements. So this is, according to the Atthadanda Sutta, is the motivation for Siddhartha's going forth. Having gone forth, as we know, he practiced with the yogis, probably the Upanishadic style yogis, who taught the formless attainments, and then he spent time doing the ascetic practices, gave all that up, recollected that time as a child practicing jhana, and then decided, Esova Maggo Bodhaya, this indeed is the path to awakening. A passage that's found very widespread in the Pali, Tibetan, Sanskrit and Chinese traditions. Went to Bodh Gaya, took some food, some boiled rice and porridge, sat down beneath the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya to meditate. And according to the accounts in the early suttas, he meditated through the three watches of the night. Of course, many different accounts of exactly what happened on that night, and the experience of awakening is seen through many different perspectives, many different lenses, sometimes described in terms of the five, understanding the five aggregates, or in terms of seeing dependent origination, or and so on. And so all of these teachings are interlinked and intertwined. If we wanted to, we could go through and analyze how that these expressions, different expressions, are really talking about the same thing in different ways, and look at the relationships and connections between these different accounts of the awakening. I'm not aware that anybody has done that in detail, but it would be certainly an interesting thing to explore. But perhaps the most common or standard description is in terms of the understanding of the three knowledges, the te vidya, or three realizations. Three realizations, of course, the first one the Buddha realized in the first watch of the night, his recollection of his past lives. In the second watch of the night, the knowledge of passing away and reappearing of beings according to their karma. And in the third watch of the night, realizing the Four Noble Truths. And of course the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta that we just recited concerns itself only with the realization of the Four Noble Truths. It's the heart of it, the core of the realization. But the first two of those knowledges are not not irrelevant. They're not kind of unrelated to the realization of the Four Noble Truths. When the Buddha recollected his past lives, that essentially that understanding of the past or vision of the past which he saw, and he emphasized the clarity and precision of that. Okay, so recollecting many past lives and recollecting all of the details, where he was born, what he was called, what he ate, and all of these kinds of things. And so it's like it's not just a kind of vague impression or anything like that, but a very clear and detailed understanding and vision of the past lives based on the practice of very deep samadhi, typically based on the practice of the fourth jhana. And so that's a very kind of systematic process. And why? What's the purpose of it? Well, he's starting to realize the extent of this thing we call samsara. Often in modernist Buddhism, they have this kind of ideology. They say, oh, the Buddha taught karma and rebirth because that was the kind of the Brahmanical beliefs at the time. But this is not true. The Buddha himself said many times that I talk about these things because I've realized it with my own direct knowledge. And he was quite capable of recognizing what was a custom that was passed down and something which could be critiqued or let go of if need be, and what was based on direct experience. And indeed there's very little evidence that the belief in rebirth and samsara was a kind of a normative and widespread belief at the time. On the contrary, it seems that there was quite a bit of philosophical discussion about these things at the Buddha's time, and several of the more radical samana groups rejected the notion of karma and rebirth altogether. So the Buddha recollected he saw these things. And what do you see? Well, of course, what you see is, you know, it was very well described in this study that I read about people who were doing their recollection of past life through hypnosis. And it was a massive study, more than 1,000 people. And one of the outstanding facts that they found out was that when they recollected their past lives, they were not, surprisingly enough, all Cleopatra in their past life. And they were not, surprisingly enough, all Napoleon in their past life. But they were farmers, carpenters, ordinary tradespeople. Most of them were farmers. They ate porridge, bread, dry bread with a bit of water. They ate out of crude wooden bowls. And again and again and again, you find in the countless accounts of past lives, the ordinary, very, very mundane reality of people's lives. It's always very important to remember that our lives here are very exotic. We have access to high technology, we have access to information from all around the world, and education, and lots of ideas and stimulation, and all of these things. And for most people, most of the time, that's not the case. For most people, most of the time, their horizons are much narrower. They know their village. They maybe know a few villages around there. They know the traditional customs. They know different things that we know. And they know more about things like what are the plants around them? What are the seasons? What animals come at what time? All of these things they know. We don't know. And a lot of the things that we know, they didn't know. And so, in that recollection of that past life, then this is what he would have been recollecting most of the time. Yes, of course, you know, you have the more exotic stories where he's born as a great king of a great realm or whatever, but most of the time, that's where we get reborn. Yeah. In a simple village or something, living a simple village life. And so, of course, nothing wrong with being in a simple village and having a simple village life, but when you're seeing it again and again and again, there's this kind of great sense of dispassion that arises. I remember Ajahnayana told me once that one of the most effective, or ads. I'm just trying to remember now what it was. He said when he was a kid, there was an ad for, I'm not sure what for like an airline or a holiday destination or something like that. And basically, the all they had to do to promote the ad or the airline was simply take footage of an average Australian suburb. So they just. They just filmed an average Australian suburb street in the 1970s and then just did an ad for the airline. You know, that's all they needed to do. This is where you're at. You know, wouldn't you like to get out of it? And so a lot of us have that feeling, a feeling of, you know, our lives are often very mundane. The reality of our lives. And we want something more. We want something deeper. We want something more satisfying. And so that was that first watch of the night, he's realizing that. And the second watch of the night is more to do with understanding what's going on, what's the causes people get, why are some lives good and some lives bad, and then realizing that's because of karma. So this is one part of that knowledge. The second knowledge is realizing it's because of karma. And then we do good and we do bad. We experience good and bad results. And of course, it's important to notice and needs to be said again and again that karma does not determine everything that we experience in our life, and it's never meant to be a kind of a blanket catch-all explanation for everything that happens in our lives. So you get something happens, oh, that's their karma. That's not how it's meant to be used. It's meant to be used in terms of understanding what's the relationship between our ethical choices and our experience of happiness or sadness. This is essentially what karma is talking about. We choose to do good, we experience happiness. We choose to do bad, we experience pain. It never says that that's the only determinant of that. It's merely saying that when we look at our ethical choices, this is what the results are. Because many other things are influencing our experience as well at the same time. So, experiencing being born in good places, bad places, and so on. And so this is one aspect. The second aspect of this is it's more of like a future orientation, and it's also a generalization of the experience. It's not just him who has those many lives, but everybody is the same way. And so now he's actually watching that process of rebirth and beings moving around. And again, this thing of restlessness going from one place to another. And in seeing this, of course, the Bodhisattva was re-experiencing and reminding himself of that fundamental parting that happened shortly after he was born. Mother disappeared And then he can see through watching this that actually that happens all the time. Everybody's life, all the time. Your mum dies, your dad dies, you disappear, you come from one place, you disappear, you go to another one. Wherever, anyone, anytime that you form an attachment to somebody, that will be broken. And when that breaks, you will suffer. And that's not just an occasional thing. It's not something you can escape from. That's how the universe is built. And so this is learning these things, that those sufferings you experience in life, they're always there. The conflict we see in society and between people, it's always there. You can never escape from conflict. Wherever you go, and even if you do escape from it, it's only temporary. You can have some relative relief from it, but you can't ever be completely freed from it. So this is what he's saying at that time. And so in the third watch of the night, then starting to see what's the solution is the untying of the knot and the unbinding of the round of samsara, and release of craving, release of attachment. And it's our cravings and attachments which lie behind our choices, lie behind the karma that we make for good and for bad. And so this is like finding that karma which is neither bad nor black nor white, but is leading to the end of karma. Yeah. So the untying through understanding, release of craving. And so as the sun rose that morning, then according to the Buddhist text, that as the dawn came up, he experienced awakening. And it's an extraordinary coincidence, if coincidence that it may be, that in the one of the most famous and beautiful of the Vedic mantras, the Gayatri mantra, this is exactly what it says, is a hymn to the sun. And it says a hymn to that great sun which impels and awakens our minds, raises up our mind and our thought. And so this, that kind of moment where the sun arises, and just like it's saying in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the eye arose, the vision arose, light arose, knowledge arose. And so the clarity and certainty are coming out of the darkness, confusion of the night time, and the clarity and certainty, it's just there, it's just coming there. And we cannot hope to fully plumb the depths of this experience. We can't exhaust the wisdom which flowed in the Buddha's mind at that time. This is something that never left him from that moment, the defilements, the ignorance. Greed, hatred, delusion, conceit, all of these defilements completely vanished forever. Now from that time, it was the Buddha's. The Buddha, of course, then had this choice on what to do after that had happened. And in the cycle of the hero myth, then this is a critical moment in the life of the hero who attains that goal. But then what are they then to do with it? Are they able to return and to reintegrate? And how do they bring that back into society? That's another challenge. So in Buddhism, the Pacheka Buddha is one who attains that goal but who does not perfect that art of reintegrating and bringing that back into the world. And they have the wisdom to find the release from suffering for themselves, but they don't know how to bring that back into the world. And so in the life of the Buddha, Siddhartha, there's that moment of hesitation. What do I do now? People's defilements are so great, their ignorance is so great, and you have to admit, he's got a point. Yeah? We've been sitting here practicing for so long and doing so much meditation, and we look into our minds, yes, you're right, Lord Buddha. The mind is full of darkness and confusion and doubt and all of those things. I can well understand that you would hesitate before coming and teaching. Is it just going to be a hassle? Big investment, small return? Yeah, is that what's going to happen? He must have, well, imagine what he's thinking. He's probably thinking, you know what they're going to do? They're going to take me and they're going to make a god out of me. They're going to make big statues of me, stick them up in big temples and come down and bow down and worship me, light incense sticks, and then wish for a new Mercedes. That's what they're going to do. I'd better off to just stay here and meditate in my cave. It must have been very, very tempting for him. Anyway, we know that that's not what he did. He came back and he taught. And he displayed that ability to bring back the Dhamma and to integrate it into the world. It is displayed constantly throughout the suttas, and especially in the Vinaya, as like a very concrete and detailed application of the principles of Dhamma towards building up and sustaining a community of actual people with actual real defilements. So this is a measure of the Buddha's genius. And to see right through the suttas, one of the very inspiring things in the suttas is the suttas is hard to convey. For me, I find it hard to convey the importance or the grandeur of the teachings in the suttas. You know, you have the sort of sometimes stilted style and repetitions and things like that. That's sort of a bit of a hurdle for some people. But one of the glorious things that you see in there is just the Buddha's effortless ability to be appropriate in whatever situation he was in. And it's nothing, it's not something which is you can grab hold of. It's not a kind of a particularly inspiring thing that you can point to in a particular event. It's just a way that he had throughout every situation, at every time. It's gentleness and evenness, which just characterize his whole way of being. And these things are things which you can just get an appreciation for, sort of deepen an appreciation for as time goes on. So, the Buddha came back, taught the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, kept on teaching, establishing the Dhamma for 45 years, they say. It's probably a fairly reasonable period of time. And then he passed away, he came back to Kusinara and passed away. And as we know, that event was a time of great dignity. It was a consummation of his whole career and his whole life. It wasn't something that was untimely. He lived a full life. His body was old, it was breaking up. He says to Ananda, some of these very vivid moments we get in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. He says to Ananda, look at these wrinkles I've got on my back, I'm getting old. And it's in that particular text, especially in the Mahaparinibbana Suttas, where you get the most, just these few little glimpses of him as a person approaching old age, approaching death, but still vigorous, still walking across the countryside and all of these things. He's not decrepit by any means. But then comes the time to lay down his body once and for all. And according to the traditions in Kusinara, which is just in the Bajan Republic, just north of the Ganges River, not far from modern day Patna, not far from Vesali. And again, you know, a lot of elaborations and so on around that night, but you do get the feeling that that account of the Parinibbana, his wanderings towards the end and so on, there is a feeling of lifelikeness to it. It feels like a genuine story. And the particular time of the Buddha's passing away, again, is sort of characterized by this great grace and acceptance, and you know, these very, very touching passages where he says, okay, would anyone like to ask any questions? Please ask. Do you have any doubts? I'm going to be passing away now. No one says anything. And he says, okay, well, if you, maybe you're just nervous to speak, so let one of you tell a friend, and then the friend can ask me. And still, no one says anything. And the Buddha's teaching and his practice had been so perfect that they didn't have the doubts. They were all clear. They all had this sense of understanding of the Dhamma. But still, when that moment came, the Buddha said his last words, "Maya Dhamma Sankhara Apamadena Sampandeta." Last words again, capturing the whole of the Buddha's teachings in just four words. Vaya Dhamma Sankhara. Conditions fall apart. Things fall apart. What Vaya Dhamma Sankhara means. You want to translate it formally, you'd say that conditioned phenomena are subject to decay. But what it just means is, in actual English, is something Buddhist hybrid English, in actual English, what it means is things fall apart. Appamadena sampadeta. Strive with diligence. So in those two lines, two phrases, only four words, he's encapsulated his whole teaching. The first part of the teaching, Vaya Dhamma Sankhara, is a summary of what is called the Majjhena Desana, is the middle teaching. It's the description of what there is, what is our existential situation, what is life, what is this that we're confronted with. Yeah. And in that, in those words, you sum this up. Things fall apart. Everything decayed. Just like my mother died after 7 days. Vaya Dhamma Sankhara. And then the second part of that is, what is our response to this? What do we do? This is what they call the Madhyama Paripada, the middle way of practice. What do we do about it? Yeah. Strive on with diligence. It is up to us to do it. We have to see that that seed of suffering, that barb, which the Buddha saw, talked about in the Atthadanda Sutta, that's in our own hearts. That's why we suffer. Because we have that, the same as everyone else has it. And going around blaming and criticizing others and why they're all wrong and whinging and all of this crap, it's a complete waste of time. Because we have the same defilements in our own hearts. It's there in our own heart. Buddha Sangharaya Nisitam. Hard to see, hiding there in the heart. So this is what the Buddha is telling us. Look for that. Where is that attachment there? Where is that craving? Why am I causing suffering for myself? Why am I causing suffering for others? Why am I causing suffering for both? Because it's there, it's that arrow in the heart. And so these were the Buddha's last words. And then he passed away. So they call the Parinibbana. And of course, what that is very mysterious. It's not a state of rebirth. It's not a state of eternal life. Something which we can say very little about. Something which, you know, to me it's like when you go to the lookout on these beautiful cliffs that we have here at Sati Monastery, and you walk down to the cliff and you come through the forest and the jungle on that path, and then suddenly you step out and you're just there, and just the world ends, and there's just this vista going on forever. How can you describe that? All you can do is just be in awe of it. That's all you can do. Just be in awe. And this is something which the Buddha's life really is an occasion for awe, an occasion for just like falling in silence before the splendor of the Buddha's life. It's not something we can encompass or reduce. We can reflect on the incredible the magnificence of what's happened because of that life, how he lived, how he died, his understanding, and the effects of that throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia, and still today we are partaking of that. And we are part of that. We are part of that tradition. It's because of the Buddha, because of his realization, every grain of rice that we eat is given to us out of kindness, out of faith, out of devotion. Because there's a recognition that, and there's a respect, a reverence for the fact that we as a community are taking part in that. We are our own little drop in that great river of the Buddhist tradition, which had its wellspring in the Buddha and his own realization, his own life. So we add just our little drop to that. This is my talk for you this evening on Vaisak and the life of the Buddha. I hope this for your reflection. And does anyone have any reflections or comments? Questions?